You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the 23rd annual Sled Dog Race takes place this weekend in Bayfield. We'll learn more about the different races taking place and what it takes to be a participant. Now, President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address before Congress last night. Here's part of his opening message.
Less than 1 year has passed since I first stood at this podium in this majestic chamber to speak on behalf of the American people and to address their concerns, their hopes, and their dreams. That night, our new administration had already taken very swift action. A new tide of optimism was already sweeping across our land. Each day since, we have gone forward with a clear vision and a righteous mission to make America great again for all Americans.
The State of the Union clocked in as the third longest in history behind two of President Bill Clinton's addresses, according to NPR. Aaron Call is director of debate at the University of Michigan and editor and co-author of the book The State of the Union Is, Memorable Addresses of the Last 50 Years. Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Well, Aaron, big picture, what is the goal a president goes in with in the State of the Union address?
Yeah, I mean, it gives you the opportunity to address 40 to 50 million people, which is very unique today. And you want to do two things mainly. You want to talk about your accomplishments in office. And so for President Trump, he got to talk about the tax cut legislation, the strength of the economy. And you also want to be forward-looking and let the country know what you want to do in the next year legislatively. And he talked about things like infrastructure spending, some funding for fighting the opioid epidemic. And so it's both looking to the past and making sure you're getting the proper credit for some things, but also showing where you want to take the country ahead of the midterm elections, which are just in November.
Before we get into some of the content of the speech, as we mentioned, this was on the longer end for State of the Union speeches. I listened on the treadmill. I got my steps in, no problem. What do you make of the length of the speech?
Yeah, I think it was way too long, and it detracted from the overall speech and message. You know, he gave an address to the joint session of Congress last February. That was 60 minutes. That's kind of, you know, pretty par for the course. And there have been some great State of the Union addresses over the years. Ronald Reagan, Lyndon Johnson, really memorable addresses that were 30 to 40 minutes in length. But, you know, in 2018, with all of the things and social media and technological advances, it's a lot to ask for somebody to sit and give you the undivided attention for that amount of time. I mean, he had some good accomplishments that he talked about early in the speech, but then by the end, you just wonder if some of those are forgotten because of everything that followed. And so I definitely think it was a bit too long, and you definitely don't want to get in that Clinton territory of 90 or so minutes, because at the time, those were derided of being way too long, and you know, Trump kind of came close to matching that.
You wrote a piece before the address suggesting President Trump take a page from President Bill Clinton's playbook, not the length of those two State of the Unions, but what lessons could a president, Trump or a future president, take from President Clinton's States of the Union?
Yeah, the Bill Clinton was, you know, length of the address notwithstanding, was excellent at getting positive results from his State of the Union addresses. In general, you know, according to data from Gallup that started in 1978, there is not very much of a bump kind of associated in job approval rating after the conclusion of these speeches. But Bill Clinton kind of, you know, went against that. And after his 96 speech, he saw a 6-point bump in 1998, all the way up to 10 points. And he really used these speeches well. He'd use it as an opportunity to kind of pivot towards the center. He talked about things like welfare reform, V-chip technology, and things like that. And also to talk about his accomplishments. The economy was very strong during that time as well. And he really was able to focus singularly on his accomplishments and kind of what he wanted his agenda to be in the future, despite a lot of scandals surrounding his administrations. There was a Whitewater investigation in 96, then the Monica Lewinsky affair became public, and then his Senate impeachment trial in 1999. And while all those things were swirling around him,
he was able to compartmentalize what was happening and just focus on the attention at hand and the address. And the public really appreciated that, and because, you know, you want the president to make sure that they have time and attention on you and your needs. And that since he was able to deliver that, I think it showed that he was an effective multitasker and still able to execute the duties of the presidency despite everything happening around him. And I think Trump tried to do that. He didn't mention Russia or the allegations of sexual misconduct or Stormy Daniels or anything like that. It was about what he had done in the economy, what he wants to do legislatively for the next year, and not even a hint of mention of all those things that are occurring, like President Nixon did in 1974, where he talked about ending Watergate after a year. There was no mention of that, and I think that's that he handled it correctly.
Aaron Call is with us, director of debate at the University of Michigan, editor and co-author of the book The State of the Union Is, Memorable Addresses of the Last 50 Years. He's putting President Trump's State of the Union address in historical context. Aaron, it's become a tradition now. I guess it wasn't always this way to have invited guests and highlighting them during the speech. How did President Trump make use of that?
I think overuse would probably be the way to describe it. Yes, that tradition started with President Reagan in 1982, and Lenny Skutnik, who was a hero that saved some people from a plane crash in Washington, D.C., and he was a federal employee. And that worked so well, and the reception was so good that every president since then has followed that. And even in the address to the joint session of Congress last February, President Trump invited Karen Owens, the widow of a Navy SEAL that had died in an intelligence raid in Yemen. And that was probably the pinnacle of that speech. And so he'd, you know, kind of gone to that well before and it had been successful. But when you expand it to over a dozen people, you know, everyone's message becomes a little bit less memorable, and kind of the uniqueness of that experience declines. And I think that it was an overuse. I see what he was trying to do, especially by recognizing so many people early in the speech. You want to build bipartisanship, get people in the audience from both sides of the political aisle applauding. But when you keep going to it, it shifts the focus to the speech over these individuals as opposed to the accomplishments and the future agenda of the presidency. And it also contributed to the long duration of the speech and this awkward clapping that occurred, where he kept clapping so much into the microphone that became a distraction as well, and, you know, proved for some fodder on social media. And so it just by having so many guests contributed to, I think, many negative parts of the speech, and it manifested itself in a lot of probably unintended ways.
I feel like I've seen State of the Union addresses that range anywhere from, you know, more symbolic, vision-oriented addresses to real nitty-gritty laundry lists of, you know, every policy item down to reorganizing the zip code. I don't know. How did President Trump do on that big-picture vision versus minutiae and detail side of things?
Yeah, it was a little bit out of the norm. You know, I don't think it neatly falls into either of those two categories. I mean, he's not a policy wonk, and, you know, like President Clinton will have a list of 100 things that he wants to do, just because in our polarized politics, those things aren't going to happen. And I don't think anybody accuses him of having a big kind of vision or philosophy. He's a relatively new politician with a, you know, kind of little experience in that area. But I think the main message of what he did was he wanted to try to connect the successes of his administration to the ordinary lives of everyday Americans. And, you know, I think that was the goal. And because it's important, the economy is doing well, yet more people still give President Obama credit, even than President Trump. And so even though he's been in office for a year, and so he really wanted to put his signature on the economic strength and show how his programs and policies help ordinary everyday Americans, which is important when we get into the midterm elections and votings and things like that. And so trying to connect those dots was something that he did, which was a little bit unique. It was close, but just because of, you know, a few things, I don't think completely hit the mark, but was a little bit ingenious in terms of the approach to that speech. I don't think we've seen it very commonly in the past.
Aaron, as we wrap up, as I understand it, originally the State of the Union was written and handed, you know, to Congress, then radio, live addresses, TV. And now we've got, as you mentioned, the internet. People can watch, they can double screen, they can watch live fact checking, live Twitter responses. The president may come up with follow ups on Twitter. Does this all change the way we interpret the State of the Union?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it used to be, you know, under 1,000 words and, like you said, written. And now it's just a much bigger production, you know, and that's in prime time and the size of the audience is so large. But no, things like fact checking in real time and, you know, the backgrounds of all of the guests are going to be there, and the short attention span. I think before there used to be State of the Unions and then the president would travel to additional states to try to keep that momentum of what the content of the speech was about to try to get the most mileage out of it. Now, what we talked about in the run up to the speech and now today with so many things in the news happening, it's a lot shorter of a window for, you know, what's going to happen in that discussion. And so it's still viewed, I think the numbers just came out, about 44 million people last night, but it's, you know, basically just one day and maybe on each other side a day or so of coverage. But the long lasting impact and way in which it frames the media narrative is really been eliminated because of the fast moving news cycle and social media and all kind of the technology that exists that, you know, don't give this its kind of exclusivity, which it has going back hundreds of years.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Anytime.
That's Aaron Call, Director of Debate at the University of Michigan and editor and co-author of The State of the Union Is, Memorable Addresses of the Last 50 Years. He weighed in on how President Trump's first State of the Union address went and how it compared to those by previous leaders. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Charles Whittlesey was born this week in 1884. When the U.S. entered the First World War, Whittlesey went too. As part of our ongoing look at Wisconsin in the First World War, journalist Meg Jones tells us about the Wisconsin-born man who led the Lost Battalion.
A century ago, Charles Whittlesey left his job as a lawyer in New York to fight in World War I. Outwardly, the mild-mannered, bespectacled Whittlesey didn't appear to have the grit needed for the brutality of a conflict that had already left hundreds of thousands of men dead and maimed. But Whittlesey proved to be a tough commander and an unlikely hero of what became the bloodiest battle for American troops in the Great War. Whittlesey was born in the tiny northeastern Wisconsin community of Florence, where his father was a logger. He attended school in Green Bay and later moved to Massachusetts, earning a Harvard Law degree. A month after America entered World War I in April 1917, Whittlesey was commissioned a U.S. Army captain and assigned to an infantry unit. He wasn't supposed to be a combat officer, but when other commanders began falling in battle, Whittlesey ended up in charge. On October 2, 1918, Whittlesey and his battalion were ordered to attack a heavily fortified German line during the Battle of the Meuse-Argonne, which turned out to be the last gasp of the war. A conscientious man known for following orders to the letter, Whittlesey led his battalion of 554 men into battle that day. The only problem was that the units on either side didn't keep up, and soon Whittlesey and his men were cut off in a steep ravine. They quickly ran out of food and water. They ran low on ammunition. Pinned down by enemy fire on all sides, they resisted snipers and attacks by waves of well-supplied enemy troops. Whittlesey's men became known as the Lost Battalion. At one point, the Germans messaged Whittlesey and his men to surrender. Whittlesey refused. He also ordered his men to remove the panels of white cloth used to signal Allied planes because he didn't want the Germans to mistake them for flags of surrender. 5 days after Whittlesey marched his troops into battle, they were rescued. They had refused to give up and fought bravely, but at a great cost. Only 194 men walked out of the ravine, Whittlesey among them. A month later, the Battle of the Meuse-Argonne ended, and so did World War I. A month after that, Whittlesey was awarded the Medal of Honor. In a sense, Whittlesey was a casualty of the Lost Battalion. For such a modest and sensitive man, perhaps it seemed as if the nation's highest medal for valor was an albatross around his neck. He returned to his job as a lawyer, but was often asked to speak about his war experiences. In 1921, Whittlesey served as a pallbearer with other World War I heroes at ceremonies honoring the unknown soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. A few days later, Whittlesey bought a ticket on a steamship sailing to Havana and committed suicide by jumping overboard. He very likely suffered from post-traumatic stress, though it was called battle fatigue then. Charles Whittlesey's body was never found.
Meg Jones is a journalist in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the largest sled dog race in the Midwest takes place this weekend in Bayfield. It's the 23rd annual Apostle Island Sled Dog Race, kicking off at 10 a.m. both Saturday and Sunday. Kelly Linehan is Director of Marketing at the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this takes place, I guess, about 10 miles outside of Bayfield and covers a pretty wide area. Can you talk about the race course?
Sure. So it starts at the Echo Valley Gravel Pit, which is 11 miles north of downtown Bayfield. And so there's signage from Bayfield to the gravel pit, and that's where the races start on both Saturday morning and Sunday morning. And then the race itself is a series of loops around the Bayfield Peninsula. So there's actually a couple different races. There's a 40-mile loop, a 30-mile loop, and a 20-mile loop, and then an 8-mile loop. So there's those four races, and then they're run both days. So the time that the mushers make is taken over the course of those 2 days. And so there's also a spectator site out in the forest where you can watch the racers come through as they kind of hit their stride out on the trail there. So it takes place over a pretty big area, not huge. And then we've also got special events in Bayfield over the course of the weekend as well.
So you said it's a 40-mile loop, so the person competing both days, they're covering overall 80 miles by with sled dogs. That sounds like a pretty grueling weekend.
Yeah, it's a lot. So that's correct. The longest race is 80 miles, and they do it 40 miles a day. So, yep, they're definitely putting on the miles.
And I understand that the different lengths of race means you're going to use a different number of dogs on your team.
Right. So that 40-mile loop, which is the 80-mile race over the course of the weekend, that's a 10-dog team. And then the 60-mile race, which they do the 30-mile loop each day, that's 8 dogs. And then we've got a sportsman's race, which is 6 dogs, and they do a 40-mile race over the course of the weekend. And then we also have a family rec race and a youth race, and they do about 8 miles each day. So that's a little bit more mellow.
And this is the big race in the Midwest. How many participants are you getting, and how far an area are they coming from?
We have about 50 teams registered right now, and so the deadline is tomorrow. So tomorrow we will be doing the bib draw. So what that is each of the mushers wears a bib with their number on it. So tomorrow morning we will be drawing the numbers, and that determines their starting positions. And we get mushers from all over the country and into Canada as well. It's mushing, it's sled dog racing, so it's kind of a localized sport in that you kind of need to have snow at least part of the year in order to do it. So it's more northern United States and into Canada, but we get them from all over the place.
If people want to come and watch, what do they need to know, A, to see it, and B, to get the most out of the race?
Well, first of all, visit our website, which is bayfield.org, and it'll run through the schedule of events for the weekend. But number one, make sure that you dress warm. The temperatures look like they're going to be right in the single digits this weekend, which is absolutely perfect for the dogs. It's a little bit chilly for humans, but definitely doable. We have a bonfire. We have a warming tent. We have concessions out at the race start and also at the spectator site. So make sure that you dress warm. When you come out to the race start at Echo Valley Gravel Pit, there isn't cell reception. So be aware of that you're going to be kind of off-grid. There'll be a lot of people around you, and you'll be among friends, but you probably won't be able to get a call in or out. So be aware of that. And also bring cash, because we won't be able to accept any credit cards for concessions or for merchandise sales or anything like that. So if you want to get a snack or get a T-shirt, just make sure you've got some cash with you, and then just come and have a good time. The best time to get out there would be about 9 o'clock, either Saturday or Sunday. And the races start at 10, but starting at 9 o'clock, we've got the mushers kind of gearing up, getting ready to go. The dogs are excited. They start singing, which is something I can't even really put into words. You have to be there to experience it. But I would say get there at 9, the action really gets started at 10, and then most of the dogs are out on the trail by about 11:30, and then you would head out to the spectator site.
And Kelly, have you tried your own hand at mushing?
I have tried my hand at mushing. I'm not very good and I'm not very fast, but it was definitely fun.
So I would think that I would worry that if I got out there even just to try it, the dogs would look at me like, yeah, come on. We know what you're doing.
That's what they did to me. So.
And you said a youth race. So how young are our kids out there doing this?
We've had kids as young as 4, actually.
Really?
Yeah, so we do actually have kids under 18 who race in the higher level ones too. A lot of times these youth mushers, like, they get started pretty early, and so by the time that they're 15, 16, 17, they're actually into the pro classes already. So the youth race is oftentimes kids ages 4 until about 12 or 13. So that's really, really fun to see. And over the past couple of years, I've been involved at the race for the past 5 years. And I've seen kids start in the youth race and then move their way up into the sportsman's race and then into the pro classes, which are the 8 and 10 dog races. And that's just always just, it's really fun to watch them, you know, progress through that. And it's a really tight-knit community that the mushers have. And it's just a really unique thing.
And are there local contenders who usually place really well in these races?
Yep, there are. Sled dog racing and just sled dog as a hobby, keeping sled dogs as a hobby here, is really popular in the Bayfield area. So we've got families in the region who do it. So oftentimes the parents have been doing it, the kids do it. We've got a couple of kids who, you know, I mean, they're contenders every year. There's the Thiel family, and they own Wolfsong and Adventures in Mushing, so they actually do trips out, sled dog trips out into the region around Bayfield. So there's Emma and Greta Thiel, who usually race, although they won't be with us this year. And then there are the Buckles Rays. So Caroline Ray usually races, and so she's been doing it for a while too. And so there's a couple different families, and it's really fun to see them out and out and about doing this kind of thing together.
Well, best of luck to everybody. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
That's Kelly Linehan from the Bayfield Chamber and Visitor Bureau talking about the big sled dog race taking place there this weekend. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The song you're hearing is likely to be familiar to anyone who spent time on the video sharing website YouTube. Keyboard Cat, which is basically exactly what it sounds like, is a video that's been viewed nearly 50 million times since being uploaded in 2007, and it helped usher in a new era of streaming entertainment. Starting as a small video streaming service in 2005, YouTube now averages about 1 billion active users every month, and it's ranked as the second most popular website in the world. Our next guest helps to make sense of it all, from cat videos to double rainbows and everything in between. He says YouTube is redefining the world of entertainment while also touching many other aspects of our lives. So what can YouTube tell us about ourselves, our society, and the future of communication? Kevin Alaka is head of culture and trends at YouTube. His new book is Videocracy: How YouTube is Changing the World with Double Rainbows, Singing Foxes, and Other Trends We Can't Stop Watching. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Kevin, you make the case in the book, if aliens came to Earth and wanted to understand our planet, you'd give them Google. If they wanted to understand us humans, you'd give them YouTube. Why is that?
Well, I think that YouTube is this real true reflection of so many aspects of the things we care about, the things we're passionate about. Video has always been sort of something that's driven by passion, by interests, by community. And we see that in the things that people watch and the things that we enjoy. Even the silliest things like Keyboard Cat, and I was laughing and covering my microphone over here when I heard the song playing at the start of this segment. But even these silly things, I think, say a lot about, you know, the things we care about and the way that we actually interact with one another.
As we mentioned, YouTube up about 1 billion active users, super popular website. What is it that resonated with people? How did it come together that it was the concentration site for all these videos that people came to see?
Well, I think, you know, in going back to kind of the early 2000s, video online was very cumbersome, and there were a number of sites that were starting to make that easier, but you used to have to download files and have, you know, special programs for watching things, and YouTube was one of the ones that really made it easy both to be able to post things and to be able to share those things, to embed them on your website. And, you know, at the time, I don't think anybody really knew what it could or should be. There was just this idea that people were interested in finding ways to express themselves, to share the things that they had captured. And over time, that sort of expanded to cover so many different aspects of our culture. And I think, you know, video and our the ability to have access to video, the ability to share video, can be used, has so many applications from, you know, entertainment and comedy. We've seen how many different types of comedy have we seen over the years, through to education, the way that people are learning and being able to access different types of knowledge from around the world, and music from different cultures, and just that ability to make something, to be able for something to spread between different places without the expense of distribution that most of us grew up with in our youths, had huge implications for a lot of different parts of our entertainment and our culture.
You write about one of the first really big viral videos that you like, actually. I want to give a listen to a guy getting really excited about what he sees up in the sky. Here's a listen.
God, look at that. It's starting to even look like a triple rainbow. Oh my God, it's full on double rainbow all the way across the sky. Oh my God.
People made fun of that one some, but I think part of the appeal, maybe you can amplify this, we've all had that, you know, natural phenomenon sighting, whether it's a double rainbow, and we're thinking, we're feeling like this guy a little bit, and we get to all share in it here.
Totally. Bear Vasquez, the guy who created that video, he believed he was having this very strong emotional, spiritual experience that day when he captured this rainbow. And he's this very boisterous character. He's very funny, and, you know, he's obviously very emotional. And I think that feeling, that joy that he's feeling in that moment is very infectious. And, you know, even though the video is almost 8 years old at this point, I think it was 8 years old. You know, he filmed it in 2010, around this time of the year. You know, he had something that he felt he wanted the world to see, and then everybody saw it and just wanted to share in it in some way with other people. And I think even though it's kind of this crazy, silly video, it represents in so many ways, I think, what's possible now, you know, for an individual person to impact culture through technology.
Talking to Kevin Allaka, author of Videocracy. He's the head of culture and trends at YouTube. And let's follow that point you mentioned, Kevin, because I think that's the main point of your book. This is an ability for someone to make their own stuff. It doesn't need to go through a studio or anything. You see that as a profound distinction that's really changing things. Talk about that.
Yeah, and I mean, and this extends both in terms of the people who watch, the people who make, and everyone, you know, everybody that's involved in how things are created and shared and spread. I mean, I think it is a when you think about how expensive it was to create a television program in the 1960s, you know, where you needed the equipment, you needed the broadcast lines. I mean, there was just so many people that would need to be involved in creating something. And lots of incredible art and entertainment came out of that and still do come out of those systems. But now we also have introduced another aspect of entertainment in which individual people are able to sort of have that distribution, be able to reach lots of other people. And we as an audience are able to find things with incredible specificity that appeal to us in very distinct and interesting ways. And, there are many, different implications for that. I think, things like entertainment are what we often think of with this, but, I mean, it goes through to all different types of passions and interests that people have, where when you have this sort of unlimited nearly amount of content that's available to us, there's so many different things that we can find and connect with.
Kevin, I don't want to overlook what some people are seeing as downsides. People want to capture views on YouTube or whatever platform they're on. The recent Logan Paul story where he had showed an apparent suicide victim on his site. I mean, people want views. Now there's a monetary reward for getting views if you're a serious YouTuber, and that is leading people into maybe some dark areas where we'd rather not see it showing up there.
Oh, there's definitely all kinds of new ethical complications that come with an environment where so many different people have the ability to influence culture. And when you have so many things happening at once, you know, there's over 400 hours of video that get uploaded every single minute now. And when you have something that's such a sort of diverse reflection of society, you inherit all the complexity that comes with that reflection of society. And, I think that the you know, people have always, especially in a place where attention is such an important driver of you know, your success, there have always been people who use, you know, shock to try to gather our attention. I mean, the truth is that most of the people that, you know, I've met over the years and that I've spoken to who have built these big audiences are very responsible and have sort of built those audiences by building real connections with people, and not just kind of trying to you know, get our attention real quick with something that's deceptive or you know, or crude. But it is, I think these are, you know, these are questions that we have, not just, you know, these are questions not that we're just going to deal with in 2018. These are questions that we're going to be dealing with, you know, for in the coming decade.
Well, Kevin, we've got full phone lines, and I don't think I've given the number yet. So I think this YouTube thing is going to be big. Let's go to our callers. Rob is on the line in Grafton. Rob, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What'd you want to bring up, Rob?
Well, I wanted to comment on how the educational aspects of YouTube have really made an impact on my life, and I think that's something that I really hope to see continue on in the future. The biggest example is learning how to code and do computer work in particular. I never knew any of this stuff up until about a year and a half ago, and as of now, I've been able to apply a lot of what I've learned from YouTube to my work.
Rob, how do you find the stuff? Do you go and search how to do such and such a program? Or?
Sure, yeah. I mean, a lot of what I've been working with lately is the R programming language and working with statistical analyses. And along with that, I originally started looking at Python programming language. And there's a wealth, overwhelming wealth of knowledge and videos out there that show how to tutorials, beginners, intermediate skills, and things like that. And it's been really helpful.
Rob, thanks a lot for that. And Kevin, I mean, I've gone on, how do I play this board game? How do I cut up a pineapple? A vegan death metal chef taught me how to make pad thai, if you want vegan pad thai with a heavy metal background. We can learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ability for us to be able to search, find the thing that we need in the moment that we need it is actually a very transformative thing. And, you know, that I really appreciated hearing that story. I love hearing stories like that because, and there, you know, I hear a lot of them across so many different things. I mean, the number of people I've met who learned how to play instruments or learned, you know, specific sort of, you know, musical techniques from watching YouTube is incredible. One of my favorite interviews in the book was from a guy named Ben Bowie who runs a channel called My Nice Ties, where he teaches people how to tie. He has the most popular how to tie a tie video on YouTube. And, you know, he's got millions of views, and he sees this viewership every New Year's Eve. He sees a big spike in views on people learning, figuring out how to tie a tie before they go out at night. You know, it's an interesting impact for one guy to be able to have on so many other people's lives.
Thanks for the call, Rob. We'll go next to Jim with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. Well, one of the things that I find most worthwhile on YouTube are the opportunity for people to do interviews with whistleblowers and people with contrarian opinions on economics and geopolitics and things like that. But what's kind of scary is that I see a similar type of repression of some ideas, censorship, like Google, you know, seems to be doing sometimes with their search engine. And so that's kind of a question that we need to examine and look at how access to contrarian opinion is not inhibited.
Jim, I want to jump in and throw that at Kevin. A lot of points of view out there, but people talk about, should, say, an explicitly pro-Nazi platform be coming up at the top of searches? How do you look at the political side of YouTube videos?
I mean, this is incredibly complicated terrain and not something that I personally work on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a tough challenge for anybody who does. I mean, obviously there's a line that exists between hate speech and things that, of course, you know, violate the guidelines of certain platforms that needs to be dealt with. But I think the question that is brought up is an interesting one of our time when you have so many different points of view. You know, how do you enable people to express themselves, be able to express ideas and opinions, while still creating a civil spaces for people that are fair and responsible?
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking about YouTube. Our guest is Kevin Alaka, author of the new book, Videocracy. He works at YouTube. He's their head of culture and trends. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your relationship with YouTube? Are you a viewer, a creator, a sharer, a YouTuber trying to make money off of it, or do you steer clear? What do you think the site has to offer that maybe can't be found elsewhere? What kind of effect is it having on us, our society, our creativity? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Kevin Alaka, YouTube's head of culture and trends. His new book is Videocracy, How YouTube is Changing the World with Double Rainbows, Singing Foxes, and Other Trends We Can't Stop Watching. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has YouTube changed the way you seek out entertainment? Do you just sit and watch videos maybe longer than you plan at the outset? Have you loaded things onto YouTube yourself? What kind of response do you get? What kind of response do you want? Do you follow a particular YouTuber or YouTubers? Are you a YouTuber yourself, somebody who's looking for followers, maybe even making money doing it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin, before we go back to our callers, I'll give you some behind-the-scenes stuff here at WPR. Back in 2012, Google did an algorithm to try to find the funniest video, I guess, on YouTube. It looked for words and sounds associated with laughter in the comments. The result was a video that we've watched and used a lot here behind the scenes. Let's take a listen to the ceiling fan video.
At first glance, taking this tomato down through these spinning fan blades may seem impossible, but I'm here to show you it's not. This must be done all in one motion. Okay, guys, watch me go to work.
I'm having a hard time not laughing just listening to it. Kevin, I don't know why we like this so much, but we do. Do we not need to try to make sense of why it's funny?
Well, I think, you know, especially when you're looking at trying to figure out what's something that everybody, you know, finds appealing, or that if you were, you know, sort of to cut across all different demographics, what would they find appealing? You know, physical comedy and things like that, of course, speak to some of our baser, you know, sort of like impulses and things. But, you know, that's kind of why things like cats and babies and those kinds of topics, especially in the early years of web video, were so popular, is because, you know, less than 20% of the views on YouTube, or even in the United States, it's something that's being watched by people all over the world. And when you look at what people all over the world watch, you kind of get this like broad cross-section of different people.
Yeah, well, we're serious intellectuals here at Public Radio. Let's go back to our callers. Ralph is with us in Chippewa Valley. Ralph, hi. Ralph, are you there? I don't think we have Ralph. The note was he built a forge for blacksmithing based on a YouTube video.
Whoa.
He saw. Super excited. So thanks for calling in, Ralph. Sorry we lost you there. That kind of basic how-to, I've like fixed computers and appliances that way, Kevin. This is something people are watching maybe with a tool in hand.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, it's one of those things where you could, if you ask people, you know, do you watch YouTube? They'll say no, and then it's like, okay, you know, but do you use YouTube, the website, to learn how to do things or do this or that? And they're like, oh yeah, all the time. And so it's like, I think we don't even realize sometimes how much this has become a part of our lives, a part of sort of learning. You know, there's so many things that you need to see done before you can really learn how to do them. And this video is really kind of an ideal medium for learning certain types of tasks, learning certain types of skills.
We're talking about YouTube with Kevin Alaka, author of Videocracy, How YouTube is Changing the World with Double Rainbows, Singing Foxes, and Other Trends We Can't Stop Watching. Back to your calls now. Brenda is with us in southeastern Wisconsin. Brenda, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Brenda?
Well, Brenda's an over-the-road truck driver, and I have a YouTube channel, and my videos basically consist of, you know, my adventures on the road, doing different things, you know, giving information, help to other people that want to get into trucking. You know, and so that's what my channel is all about. And it's so freaking cool that YouTube has allowed us to do things like that, you know.
And Brenda, do you have, like, do you feel like you have a community that's following you on YouTube?
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, I do.
What's your,
yes,
what,
I do.
What's in the works for the next video, Brenda?
Well, I, got hit by a deer.
Oh, no.
And, I mean, it was like, yeah, yeah, and I did a video of it. I just haven't uploaded it yet. And it messed up the whole front of my truck. It was, it had the big horns and everything. It was a buck. And it messed up, it tore out my passenger light. It tore up the grill. And then it knocked out my fuel filter. And so I was on a two-lane road, and I had to, I thank the Lord I was able to pull over, you know, into this parking lot, because that was the end of it. My truck wouldn't go anymore. So that's my next video.
Brenda, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. Kevin, you've met a lot of people like Brenda, maybe not doing exactly what she's doing, but sharing a piece of their lives.
Yeah, and I know what I'm doing after this interview, and that's subscribing to Brenda's channel, because that sounds awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think that that is actually the joy that I get out of sort of studying this stuff is, you know, that's not a thing that would make sense as a TV show from a big production studio necessarily, but makes perfect sense in a space where there are other people who are interested in what Brenda has to say and the experience that she's having. Maybe their experiences are similar, and that experience can exist for them. And she probably doesn't have a big crew or anything around the videos that she makes, but it doesn't make them less compelling to the people who watch them.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Brennan. I'm glad you're feeling okay, even though parts of your truck didn't make out so well. Let's go back to our callers. Chris is on the line in Green Bay. Chris, hi.
Hey.
What do you want to tell us about?
To me, YouTube is not entertainment necessarily. It's more like I use it for an exchange of ideas. Introduce my daughter to new ideas and let her watch TED Talks. And TED Talks has some new cartoonish kind of oddball things that you can learn about. She learned about urine the other day. She wanted to watch it 3 or 4 times. I watch a lot of lectures and debates, Ken Ham and Bill Nye stuff, Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss. There are a lot of ideas on there that normally don't get around unless you're at a lecture.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing that. TED Talks, I imagine, drives a fair amount of traffic on YouTube, Kevin.
Oh, TED Talks are hugely popular. Not, you know, a TV channel or a channel of educational lectures sounds like an odd proposition if you're trying to make something that you want a lot of people to watch. But yet when you put it up in these spaces, you find, oh, wow, actually there's a huge demand for that kind of stuff. And there have even been some of these, some channels now have become celebrities by, you know, creating educational things. Like two of the guys I spoke to for the book were from a channel called ASAP Science. They created whiteboard animations of different scientific, you know, concepts. They used to joke around with their friends, you know, at the bar about science. They turn that into a YouTube channel. They have millions of subscribers who tune in for these really cool animations they do around different topics. And so, you know, that idea of people exchanging ideas, of exchanging knowledge, can actually lead to real popularity that rivals some of what we think of as mainstream entertainment.
It's a good place to leave it, Kevin. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Kevin Alaka. He's the head of culture and trends at YouTube. His new book is called Videocracy, How YouTube is Changing the World with Double Rainbows, Singing Foxes, and Other Trends We Can't Stop Watching. Still time to share your thoughts. What do you use YouTube for, if you use it at all, or do you avoid it? If so, why? You can let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.